Okay, today is July 8th, 2021. This is an interview with Stephen Cook. We are doing this interview for Academic Staff Award Winners Oral History Project. My name is Troy Reeves. This interview is being done remotely through Teams, so I'm in my home in Madison, Wisconsin. Steve, for sound quality purposes, could you start by saying your name and spelling your last name?
Stephen Cook, COOK, but go by Steve, so
Okay.
that's fine. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Steve. All right. So as I said just before I hit record on the tool, that we're just going to start at the top here. And that first question off that topic list I gave you is what brought you to UW-Madison?
Well, where should I begin? No, so I grew up in Wisconsin. I grew up in Oshkosh, and had gone away to school in Minnesota at Carleton College for undergrad, and then out to DC where I worked for the US Agency for International Development after my undergraduate education. And became interested in pursuing sort of further work in international development. So I applied to a bunch of schools, and including the sociology program here at Wisconsin, which has a part of that program which is focused on the sociology of what they call the sociology of economic change, but it's focused on issues around economic development. Just from having grown up in Wisconsin, I was familiar a little bit with Madison, and had some friends that I had been in undergrad with who were in the sociology program here. When I was accepted here, and along with the fact that being from in-state allowed me to get do and have in-state tuition, there was a good incentive for me to come to Madison, and I've not regretted it. So yeah, so it was to come back to grad school to participate in sociology program.
I have my mic on mute, okay, so I don't have any background noise, and I keep forgetting that I do that. But you can hear me now. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the time that you came for graduate school, and then maybe a little bit about the graduate work itself before we get into some of this other stuff.
Sure. As I said, I had started to I come here with the intention of pursuing the sociology of economic change program, but there was a funding offer, a traineeship in the demography program. So demography is another part of the sociology program. So I kind of had in my mind is, well, okay, I'll combine in the sociology of economic change and demography into a program. Came here and did some work in that as a early grad student, and then was hired as an RA by Gary Sandifer, who was sociology professor and then later went on to greater and better things here and then later at Oklahoma State, to work on a book that he was doing, looking at the role that growing up in a single parent household plays in young children's lives, and how it relates to their economic outcomes especially. And so that work got me a little bit more focused on looking at underprivilege in America, in the US, and a little less in the international aspect of what I had originally come for. And through Gary, got involved in some other projects that were being run through IRP, projects that Maria Canshon and Dan Meyer both were heading here. And so I was a very slow progressing grad student, and by so I'd come in 1991. By the late 90s, I had finished my master's, but was still sort of very early on in the ABD process. And so they asked, I guess had were happy with the work that I had been doing as an RA, and asked if I would be interested in working full time for IRP. So some of the projects they were working on in IRP. So I accepted and started doing that in 2000, September of 2000.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
So
now I want to, I think, back up a little bit, even sort of pre-UW-Madison, to ask about what factors led to your, to both your research interest and then, you know, eventually this, the work that you're doing.
It's all been a little happenstance, and sort of, you know, I come across things and there are opportunities and I pursue those opportunities, rather than having gone into this with a clear goal or purpose in mind. My undergraduate degree was in history. I went out to DC, very much on kind of a whim, thinking I could find a job that was related to, public policy or, and kind of lucked into this job with USAID. But that, you know, so I think the constant signal through all of this has been kind of my interest in being involved in public policy and thinking about the way that public policy can affect people's lives. And so, you know, that was true at USAID. That was sort of what I came back to grad school to pursue. And even though the focus of that shifted a little bit to be more about the U.S. rather than international, I really was very much interested in pursuing a career in and thinking about the ways in which public policy can help underprivileged people. And thought very much that even a grad school degree would lead to that kind of work, research and evaluation work or public policy development work, rather than being a faculty somewhere. I was never really on the academic track or the tenure track, even here pursuing my PhD. When this opportunity arose, very much fit into that desire of being able to be involved in work that was very much focused on public policy. Almost all the work that I do at IRP is work that is either for state agencies or federal agencies, and relevant to policy development and programmatic questions that they're interested in. And so, you know, very much feel like I'm doing work that is likely to lead to policy changes or directly result in outcomes that will positively affect people's lives. But I get to do it in this great academic environment where I'm surrounded by people who, you know, think very rigorously about the right way to do things methodologically, and plus all the other benefits of being in an academic environment, all the great things about being on a university campus. So.
Great, thank you. So I think this will lead into the next question, but I think even though we have oral histories and we have documentation about the Institute for Research on Poverty, I wonder if you could, you know, spend just a couple minutes explaining to whoever might listen to this what that institute is and what it's all about.
Yeah. So IRP, Institute for Research on Poverty, is a multidisciplinary research center here on campus as part of the College of Letters and Sciences. But it's been around since the mid 60s. It was originally developed as kind of part of the original War on Poverty. Lyndon Johnson's program back in the 50s. Robert Lampman was an economist here at IRP who was involved in the development of the Social Security program and other public benefit programs that were being developed in the 60s, and got federal funding to put together this poverty research center here on campus. And it's existed for, you know, well over 50 years now. It's had funding from the federal government all of that time. First kind of direct funding, and then later we go through every 3 to 5 years, there's a competition that the Department of Health and Human Science Services does to award funding to a poverty center on campus. And every single one of those funding rounds, IRP has received at least some funding from that. So we are currently and sort of traditionally call ourselves the National Poverty Research Center for the country. You know, a lot of work happens here looking at welfare programs, welfare reform, child welfare, child support, ways that funding goes into public education. So a lot of different aspects of public policy that can affect poor people.
Thank you. So now let's shift that. And you've talked about this a little bit in some of the answers to the questions, but let's talk directly now. When someone asks, you know, what do you do for IRP? How do you describe what you do?
Well, in very general terms, I look at public issues around public policy effectiveness and efficiencies in the way that public policy programs are run, and how those policies can affect people, primarily underprivileged people. And so, you know, sometimes that's very specific. A public agency will come to us with, oh, we're thinking about doing this new policy. Can you tell us what you think the results of doing something like this would be? Sometimes it's they get funding from the feds to do something, and part of that funding says this needs to be evaluated. So they will come to IRP and ask for and work and do a contract with us to do an evaluation of some new public policy that's happened. On a kind of more specific level, and sort of as to what I do, my job is kind of dual fold. One is I pursue my own research agenda. So I have done work as part of contracts around child welfare, you know, looking at questions about when you take children out of the home because of child abuse or child maltreatment. What are some policies that will help the parents get back to a point where they can bring those children back home? I've also looked at, you know, some issues around if you can't bring those children back home, what's the best way to sort of identify a new parent that might adopt those children? And so working on some policies around that. I've also done a lot of work around child support. So when parents split up, and one parent is required to pay child support to the other parent for the raising of their children. You know, what policies help those parents pay those child support obligations? And so those are all kind of in my specific research agenda. And I've been involved in other people's projects that look at those questions, and I've led a few of those projects on my own. But in addition to that, we at IRP have put together a large administrative data resource that basically is there to provide data for people to look at all sorts of questions around public policy. And we work with state agencies in Wisconsin to get access to their administrative data and have built what we call the Wisconsin Administrative Data Core. With those state agencies, that, you know, so we collect data from the state welfare system, and data from the child welfare system and the child support system, and the Department of Corrections about people who are in prison, and DPI about children's educational experiences, And we bring that to IRP and we merge all that data together and create this resource that has been extremely valuable to let people, you know, apply for research funding. And they say, oh, you know I can do, I can look at this research question because the data already exists and has already been put together to do these kind of questions. So that working on putting that data resource together is right now probably what occupies the majority of my time. It requires a lot of negotiation with state agencies, all that data shared, with formal data sharing agreements. But there's also just a lot of relationship building where you have to get those agencies to trust you. And so that means, you know, basically a lot of handholding and communication and just this is what, yes, we have your data and this is how we're keeping it safe and secure and this is how we're using it and we're keeping you informed about all of this. So that's a big chunk of my time there.
Just maybe a quick follow-up about that. Since you're working with state agencies, and I assume you've been doing this most of your time at IRP, I wonder if you could talk about how perhaps changes in administration have changed or maybe not changed the work that you've tried to do with these state agencies.
Yeah, so that, you know, that has always been a big fear that we've had is that these relationships we have with state agencies will disappear with the change of an administration, or that they will perceive that, oh, this initiative is the product of the previous administration and we don't want to support it. You know, not necessarily because we think you're doing anything bad or that you're misusing data or anything, but it's just, you know, we don't want to support whatever the old guy did. Fortunately, you know, we've managed to avoid that. And a lot of that is, I think, due to some conscious efforts on our part to make sure that we're establishing relationships, you know, through the full breadth of an agency. So we don't just go and talk to departmental leadership. That departmental leadership changes with each new administration. But we have very strong relationships with kind of mid-rung people, the people who stay from administration to administration, and try to make it clear to them by word and deed the value of the work that we're doing for their work. And so when new administrations come in, I think the message that gets pushed from the bottom up is you know, that this is an incredibly valuable resource for these state agencies to allow them to get the answers and the policy decisions that they want to have. And we're certainly determined not to compromise our academic values in the work that we do, but at the same time, we're sort of conscious of the political nature of some of the work that we do and try to present that work in as politically neutral a terms as we can. So, you know, it's about the findings we have. It's not about supporting one political ideology or agenda or another. And so that's, you know, I think that has been a very important kind of value that we've maintained and has allowed us to maintain strong relationships regardless of those changes in federal or state administrations.
Thank you. So I want to give you space just to talk a bit more if there are other things that comprise a typical day. I know you said that the work around the data core is a large amount of the work that you do, but are there other things that you do during, again, I put in quotes, typical day?
Most of the research agenda type work that I do involves statistical quantitative analysis. So as I said, a big chunk of my sociology training was in demography. And so that means a lot of the research and analysis that I do is statistical. So other people go out and talk to people in the field and, you know, do surveys or collect data or have conversations with people. I mostly look at administrative data and see how, you know, how does this variable relate to this variable? And, you know, if we change this particular policy, how does it affect this outcome that we see in the data? And so that means a lot of, you know, sitting at a computer and writing code in programming code and running statistical models and seeing whether differences are statistically significant. That's the key threshold that we sort of use to determine whether things we're seeing are important or not. And so that's, you know, that's a very solo kind of work. Mostly, you know, it's stuff you do alone, sitting at a computer. Now, some of the prep work for that and sort of, you know, making sure the data is prepped in a way that allows that kind of work involves collaborations with other people at IRP who are involved in that. The data side of my job is meeting. So that's, that has been, I go and have probably 3 or 4 meetings a week with people at state agencies or people. I also kind of interface with faculty and other staff people here at UW who are interested in using that data and are putting together research projects. So I'll also meet with them and talk about how their research project idea may or may not benefit from the data that we've collected. And if so, how we can get permission for them to use that data for their project and what funding would be necessary to make that happen and things like that. So a lot of meetings. Due to my work with the state agencies on data issues, I've been asked to do, be involved in some policy kind of consultation with state agencies as well. So a few years ago, served on a Wisconsin Legislative Council committee on issues around fraud in welfare use. And I've been working with the state court system on an advisory panel on their research and evaluation priorities for the council. So, I've got to have some interactions with higher up people on kind of high level policy things as well. But most of it is a little bit more sort of in the trenches work, looking at sort of how do we make the logistics of this data access happen and that. Obviously, all of that side of things have changed a lot with the pandemic. And so things have for the most part, have continued with lots and lots of meetings and just all happening online now. And I get to sit at home in my office, as most of us have for the last year. But yeah.
So since you mentioned COVID, I'm wondering, and you talked about this one, the change that almost all of us have gone through, and that's moving from face-to-face meetings to remote meetings. Are there other ways that the pandemic has changed your work over the last 15, 16 months?
No. I mean, the big answer is no. I'm meeting largely with the same people that I met with before. There has been some, obviously issues of responsiveness. State agencies have been, I think the university did an incredibly amazing job of picking up the ball. Things like, oh my God, how do we do this in a completely different environment? And I think the university really, was incredible in providing the resources, the tools, access to the necessary tools, to allow most of the work that I do to continue pretty much in the same way. So I've had remote access to all of the computing resources that I've needed, the virtual meeting tools and virtual conferencing tools that we have been great. Many of the state agencies were not quite as nimble in picking that up. And so there have been a lot of delays in their sort of responsiveness to requests that we make of them, their ability to have meetings, their ability to make decisions about things. And I think some of that has been due to COVID. And so, that has a kind of secondary impact on us because we're not getting the responses that we need sometimes to do the to make decisions that we need to make and things like that. But in terms of, the basics of sitting down and doing the computer work for my research work, or doing the meetings that I need to have for the data access kind of side of things, almost all of that is continued kind of in a different format, but pretty much the same work that was going on before.
Okay, so I want to ask you this technology question sort of writ large, about your 20 years and maybe even your work as a grad student too. And so, how have changes in technology changed your work?
I started as a grad student in 91. So that was, people were using email by then, which was not true in my undergraduate years or in my or even in my work at USAID in the late 80s. But by the 90s, sort of the primary means of communication that we had with people was by email. And so that has happened. And the IRP has had access to pretty well-developed statistical computing resources, back from the very beginning. Of course, back in the very beginning in the 60s, it was punch cards and, much more primitive kind of computing technology. But so we've had access to all of that. The IRP is part of or a member in the Social Science Computing Cooperative, which is kind of a computing hub on campus, an IT department on campus that's kind of set up by IRP, the sociology department. I think economics was involved for so a few depart social science related departments sort of had developed their own IT department. This is before Doit existed, and the campus was really providing the full range of computing resources that we need. So we've been very lucky to have that computing resource available to us. Of course, the scope and scale and speed of those computing resources has dramatically changed over the years. And so, now we're in a position, the data core that I talked about has 8 million people in it. And all of their programmatic participation and welfare and all these other programs that I mentioned over the course of 20 to 30 to 40 years in some cases. And so it's very large, big data sets that we're dealing with. That's not data that we could have dealt with back 20 years ago. But the computing resources have kept up to allow us to do all that. One of the big changes that's happened is a constant and steady concern about confidentiality and privacy issues. And so, we've always, of course, have always been concerned about making sure that we're keeping data secure. But the concerns from the state agencies about that have ratcheted up over the course of time, often in response to publicity about some bad thing happening. Fortunately, never with us, but either internally in their agencies or elsewhere. Some of the data we have is HIPAA protected data. There are federal requirements around the way that kind of data is protected. There's also school records we have, and so there's FERPA also requirements. As all those requirements have come into place, we've had to turn to the Social Science Computing Cooperative to develop new security measures, and those have involved the Campus Office of Cybersecurity as well. So in the last 4 to 5 years, we've essentially created a whole new super secure server system that allows us to store this data in a way that would make it much more difficult for bad actors to get access to that data, and also allows us to keep track in a better way of who has access to the data and control when and where and how that data can be used. And so addressing that has been very laborious, because it's to some extent we were inventing the wheel along with the Office of Cybersecurity and SSCC, in sort of trying to figure out, well, what exactly do these federal requirements mean? And what specifically do we have to do to implement security arrangements that comply with those? I think we're finally in a position where we have a system that one, certainly meets all those requirements, and two, seems to have assuaged all of the concerns that those state agencies have voiced over the years. And so feeling pretty good about that, knock on wood.
Right. Yep. Okay, Steve, I want to switch to a few questions about academic staff, being academic staff in general. The first is, or were you or have you been involved in academic staff governance or groups?
So I really haven't, and that's I think at this point in my career, that's actually been a little bit of a regret that I did not get involved early. I think some of that was due to my early on, I sort of was thinking myself as much of a student as a student, even after I had started working full time for IRP. I was still ABD, and still kind of thinking of myself half as a student, half as staff. And so, I sort of said, oh, well, the staff thing is of interest to other people, not so much to me. I think I could play more of a role, and I'm looking forward to the possibility of doing so in the future, but so far, no.
All right. So then, the next question is a general question about, in your time here, have you thought about the relationship between faculty and staff? And if so, what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, when you sent over the list of questions, that was the one I sort of had to think hardest about. And it's a good question. I personally have felt very, very well treated by faculty. So I think some of that's kind of the selectivity of who has run things here at IRP, the faculty that have been involved in IRP. We've had a great series of faculty directors at IRP who almost all of them have gone on to be involved in higher up university governance. As I mentioned, Gary Sandifer and Maria Canchon, and Carl Schultz was a director here as well, and Lonnie Berger, who now is working in the provost in the no in the vice chancellor for research's office. For the most part, all of those directors have, I think, very much perceived that academic staff and universities classified what was were classified staff and now university staff, were important partners in making IRP run well, and it was very much a collaborative sort of leadership process rather than a we're here to support our star faculty members. That's not to say that I haven't occasionally run into faculty members who are feel a little bit more entitled or sort of demanding, but that has been a very infrequent occurrence. And for the most part, I have felt, when dealing with situations like that, I felt well supported by the leadership in IRP to give the responses back that I needed to give as the requirements of the job dictated. It's never been a huge problem. Mostly very, I think it's been very positive relationship. And valuable. I mean, it's not just, what are they treating me well or not treating me well? I felt like a partner in people's research projects, my expertise in certain areas has been recognized. My knowledge about the data that we put together has been recognized. And I've been brought in as kind of an expert resource by faculty to contribute to some of their projects. And so, it's not just been a benign relationship. It's, it's been one that I have found very positive. For the most part, and also valuable. Not only am I gaining from my expertise to the whatever it is, but I'm certainly gaining from the amazing expertise of the people that work on the, for the faculty people that work on this campus. So.
Great. The last question before I ask you if you have anything to add is a story about the award itself. So, you won the Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Research, Critical Research Support. So, from the time nomination through the reception, anything that jumps out that you want to address about that?
Yeah. My nomination for that was something that I'll confess that I pushed a little bit. I was aware that these awards were out there and people got them. There have been some IRP people that have gotten these awards in the past. And I sort of, looked at my career and the things that I had done and thought I might be a good candidate for this. And I will admit, kind of mentioned it, nudged my supervisor and institute leadership. They were very quickly responsive to the idea and eager to make that happen. I feel like hopefully I was completely out of line in pushing that at the beginning. Was quite surprised to have gotten it kind of on the first time I was nominated, not because I felt like my accomplishments were lacking so much as I know how much other good stuff goes on this campus, and just felt for certain that there must be lots of very well accomplished people who would have applied for these awards, and that the competition would be quite steep. Of course, I have no idea exactly what the situation was in that regard, but certainly felt very humbled and honored to have received the award this year. So that was stunned a little bit right at the beginning, but yes, very proud.
And can you talk a little bit about the reception? Because I assume it was virtual.
It was. So, I mean, frankly, as many of our experiences this year, a bit of a, anticlimax or a little bit of a disappointment in that we couldn't all meet in public, in person, and share in each other's accomplishments in person. I would have enjoyed that opportunity, but I thought the committee did, or whoever put that together, I guess the academic staff faculty, I'm sorry, the academic staff, secretary of the academic staff had put that together. And I, given the limitations that we were all under, I thought they did a great job, and I was very happy to be that. We got, received our a little snack, kind of the food that I think, normally would have been sent out at the in-person meeting, got sent to us as a delivery, along with the plaque and everything like that. So it was a good second best.
Thank you, Steve. So before I ask you if there's anything about your time you want to discuss, I do want to ask a question since we have a couple minutes. You've mentioned a couple of times about the word, you've mentioned the word underprivileged. And so I'm wondering if you would talk about, your journey on how you have decided upon working with and working for a group that is interested in trying to help out those who are less privileged than others.
That's a tough question to answer. I mean, it's, I know some people, sometimes people will pursue a certain area because, oh, I grew up in a poor family, I have had experience with people who are in an underprivileged situation, and I wanted to help understand that better. And certainly, I've known people who are less privileged. My personally, I mean, my family was that I grew up in was a sort of solidly middle class family. My parents both worked at the university in Oshkosh, and so I don't really have that personal touchstone that made me pursue this. But I. To some extent, I think it's kind of a recognition of that somewhat privilege that I grew up with, both economic privilege and demographic privilege, is something I recognize was just, kind of luck. I recognize that there's a lot of people in our society who are not fortunate to have a stable family to grow up in, or a family with resources to send them off to college, or some of those things that I have. And so, I think it's much more a recognition that there's a lot of inequality in our society. And there will always be. I'm under no illusion that we're ever going to do anything that dramatically changes that base that people start at. But we can. There are policies that can help people overcome those initial hurdles. And frankly, I think it's the responsibility of society and the government that we elect. To do all it can to help people achieve their full potential, and that means making sure that they have the resources, especially as children, to establish a good life for themselves. So that's sort of where I've come from my interest and concern about these issues.
Thank you, Steve. So the last question is, really to see if there's other things in the few minutes we have about your UW time that you would like to get on this oral history.
Yeah, so I think I hinted a little bit about this before when I talked about what an ideal kind of job and situation I perceived working at IRP to be, and it allowing me to be both involved in the kind of hands-on, influential policy related research that I've been able to do, but at the same time being in this academic environment where you have, I mean, just the stimulation and expertise that you're kind of constantly surrounded with. So every day I find myself involved in conversations with extremely smart people who know a lot about some particular area, and sometimes that doesn't lead to anything, and other times it's like, oh, this the fact that you've said something about some field that I've never really been interested in or never really had an involvement in, but oh, that actually kind of relates to work that I do. And I mean, it's just a cauldron to in which one's intellectual environment is just, is always has the potential for being stimulated and for developing new ideas, and just working with students. So I'm not a faculty member, so I'm not out teaching classes or anything like that, but I do work with a lot of students who are working as research assistants and project assistants on these various projects. A lot of them are very smart and bring interesting things to the table, but it's also just kind of a joy to work with incoming people like that and help them get started on their way as well. So I think the big thing is just, just an expression of what a positive experience I find working on a university campus is. And I think probably UW is this way as much, if not more, than a lot of other universities, where things like the Wisconsin idea are actually, are valued. And working with state agencies on these kind of questions are valued and recognized as being an important part of the academic experience, and we're not just an ivory tower. So I think that's kind of the big important my big important feeling about this job and the work I've done over the last 20 years as an academic staff member here.
Great. Well, thank you for that, those final thoughts, and thank you for the time you gave me. I want to talk with you a minute or two after we shut down the recording.
Sure.
But this concludes the oral history with Steve Cook. Steve, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. Glad to chat.